Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At the end of last March, Palestinians in Gaza launched a series of protests to demand the right of return. They also called for an end to the land, air, and sea blockade of Gaza that Israel imposed in 2007. These protests became known as the Gaza Great March of Return. Last week, a commission set up by the UN Human Rights Council released findings that Israeli forces may have committed war crimes by targeting children, journalists, medics, and people with disabilities. The commission found that between March and December of last year, 189 Palestinians, including 35 children, were killed at demonstration sites. More than 6,000 unarmed demonstrators were injured by live fire from Israeli forces. Many people lost limbs. More than 3,000 others were injured by shrapnel, rubber-coated bullets, or tear gas canisters. According to Amnesty International, 70% of civilians in the Gaza Strip are registered refugees from parts of what is now Israel. They have endured more than a decade of blockade and three wars. Gaza now faces an unemployment rate of 44%. Movement in and out of Gaza of both people and goods is tightly restricted under the blockade. Today, we will speak with one of the organizers of the Great March of Return about his vision for what could be achieved through protests and what a future for Palestine would look like. Today, we are joined by Ahmed Abu Artima, a Palestinian journalist, poet, activist, and refugee. He is one of the original organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return, and Ahmed joins me in studio. Hi, Ahmed. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. We're also joined by Jihad Abu Salim, a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza, currently studying at New York University. He left Gaza 5 years ago. He's also doing work with the American Friends Service Committee. And Jihad also joins us in studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Noam Perry, Program Associate of Economic Activism at the American Friends Service Committee. Noam is coordinating Ahmed and Jihad's visit. They will be speaking in Berkeley tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue, and then they will be off to San Diego, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, New York, Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, Georgia. And Noam also joins us in studio. Noam, thank you so much for driving them over here, coordinating these events, and coming to the studio.
It's really my pleasure. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you so much. Before we dive in and talk about the protests, I just want to provide some context, because in the United States, you hear about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you hear about Gaza and the West Bank, but you don't really hear details about what is happening in Gaza today. So, Ahmed, can you give us a sense, what is the population in Gaza today, and what is just daily life like?
Yeah. Thank you again for having me. Gaza Strip is a real prison. It's a small part from Palestine. And it's one of the most population density in the world. 2.2 million Palestinians live inside Gaza. Only in 141 square miles. No crossings connect Gaza with the outside world normally. Because the seaport Israeli occupation forces prevent Palestinians from building seaport or from leaving the sea, or and they prevent anyone from outside Gaza to come in. This is despite Israel claims they pulled out from Gaza in 2005. And they destroyed the only airport in 2001. They destroyed it completely just after 3 years from its building. There are just two crossings, one of them on the border with Egypt, and this is have a lot of difficulties to travel by it. As example, I'm personally still waiting for 6 years before I succeeded finally to leave Gaza, and there is another crossing from the north side, which Israeli forces controlled, and they give the permit just for very few people to travel by Eretz crossing. So the majority of the people inside Gaza never left Gaza all their lives. They never saw a plane. They never saw a river. They never saw used a train. They never spoke with other people from other culture, from other country. The unemployment inside Gaza is very high because Israel destroyed hundreds of industrial factories in the three aggressions in 2008, then 2012, then 2014. Gaza, according to the United Nations reports, is unlivable just in 2020, just next year. So the human conditions inside Gaza is very high, is unbearable.
Now, you said it's the population is about 2 million?
2.2 million.
And according to various figures, about 43% of the population is aged 14 or under?
Yeah. And the generation of youth, the majority of them never leave, never travel in their life.
What do they think about that? The fact that they cannot travel, they cannot go anywhere.
Yeah.
What do they say about that?
Yeah. I think this is a real killing for the humanity. This is stripping them from their humanity. Imagine when I came here to United States and I used trains and connect with peoples. So I discovered how the people from different cultures and from different countries are very similar. We are all of us the same humans. But when you separate a complete people inside the prisons between fences and don't allow to them to leave, to communicate with other peoples, then Israel by this actions it push these people push these people to make walls between the peoples. So this is the start of conflicts in the world. If you want to make stability, if you want to make peace in the world, so let the people connect each other. Because when they connect each other, they can be more empathy, more understand each other. Yeah.
Jihad, can you also talk about this? Why can't people leave? So let's say, for example, someone wants to study abroad, whether in the Middle East, Europe, the United States. Can someone in Gaza do that?
It's almost impossible for most young Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to travel to the outside world. Just speaking from my personal experience, when I got admitted into a PhD program, a prestigious PhD program at New York University back in 2013, it took me 4 months to just get to Jerusalem for one day to do a 15-minute visa interview at the U.S. consulate. I had to apply for multiple permits. I had to assign 3 lawyers to take legal action against the Israeli military in order to push for my right just to have a two-hour car ride from the Gaza-Israel crossing Erez to get to Jerusalem. And then the second half of the nightmare was also trying to get through the Rafah crossing that connects Gaza with the outside world through Egypt, and this crossing closes more often than it does open. The reason why Palestinians in Gaza, be them students, patients, also ordinary people, are unable to travel has to do with the policy of closure and blockade that Israel has been following and pursuing for years against the Gaza Strip. And this has to do with using collective punishment as a mean to achieve an end of bringing Palestinians in Gaza to their knees, to surrender, to give up their dreams and their ambitions for a better future by imposing collective punishment on them. The collective punishment worsened after the international community and Israel did not like the results of our democratic elections that were held in 2006 and followed this kind of policy of blockade that traps people behind these walls and fences, thinking that by doing so, they would be capable of imposing their agenda on the population there. But this policy itself, the first problem with it is that, number one, it's a policy of collective punishment, as I said, and number two, it deprives all people of their natural right to travel and to see the world.
Jihad, you are a PhD candidate studying history and Hebrew and Judaic studies. You said it took 4 months just to get to Jerusalem. How did you finally end up at New York University, given that it is so difficult to leave Gaza?
So I was lucky to leave 1 week before the Rafah crossing was... So after I got my visa, when I went to Jerusalem, I finally, with the help of a human rights organization called Gisha, based in Israel, I managed to do my visa interview, and then I got my U.S. visa right away because I had an admission, I had a scholarship, and then I traveled to the U.S. through the Rafah crossing, which connects Gaza with Egypt. So you apply for you register your name as a traveler in Gaza, and then you join lists of thousands of people who are hoping to travel through Rafah. And I was lucky to leave Gaza just 1 week before the Egyptian regime sealed off the crossing for once and for all. Then and then, you know, it was basically all of 2013. For me was 1 year that just went to waste of me trying to attend to these simple things. Here in the U.S., people, when they decide to travel, they just book their flight online, go to the airport. That's it. You know, if they complain, they complain about how long the security line was, mm-hmm. and whether the flight was full or not, or whether the snacks were good. But for us, you know, when we want to travel, we think about that years ahead of time. And we think about what it takes to get an Israeli permit. The Israeli permit system is very complicated. Israel has more than 100 types of permits that it grants to Palestinians who are wishing to move freely in a region, Israel-Palestine, the whole region is in the size of the state of New Jersey, but sometimes it takes people years just to get from one part to another. And then, you know, people also think about whether they would be able to leave through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. So it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare that we live and experience on a daily basis. And for me, now it's easier for me to meet other Palestinians from the West Bank, from the diaspora in America, than it's easier for me to meet them in Gaza and to go to the West Bank. I've never been to the West Bank, although it's just 2 hours from where I live in Gaza.
So the West Bank is 2 hours from Gaza, but you cannot go there.
I cannot go there, and I only got to meet Palestinians from the West Bank in the U.S.
What was that like for you?
It felt like a dream in the beginning. It felt like, you know, I finally felt that this is a complete homeland for me. Those are my people. We share the same language. We share the same culture. We share the same dreams. We share the same hopes. Yet we are unable to meet. We are unable to fall in love. Imagine if you're from Gaza and you fall in love with someone from the West Bank, someone from Haifa or from Nazareth. It's impossible to even you put limitations on your feelings, on your emotions. Many families have been unable to reunite as a result of these walls and fences that Israel has erected around Palestinian territories and Palestinian towns and cities. So for me, it was a beautiful thing, but also it was sad because, you know, we as people, when we meet outside Palestine, we experience the beauty of our gathering, the beauty of our unity. We realize what is it that we are deprived of.
You wrote a piece in Vox. You said that you have not been able to return, visit, or see your family and friends in Gaza. Have you been able to return since writing this piece?
Unfortunately, no.
So you've been here for 5 years?
Yes.
and you cannot return to Gaza to see family and friends.
It's almost impossible. I mean, theoretically, it's possible, but if I get to Gaza today, if I fly to Gaza and it would take me days to get there, I might risk getting stuck, and this will make me, you know, either like miss out on my studies or lose my scholarship or be unable to come later and defend my thesis or meet with my advisors. So most of students who leave Gaza, they don't return because they're afraid, they're worried about the risk of getting stuck there and then be unable to leave again. So it's a nightmare for all of those students, young people who leave and they never get to see their families. I haven't seen my family since I left, and I got married just in end of 2017, and I tried to help get my family come to attend the wedding, but unfortunately they weren't able to do so, and they attended my wedding on FaceTime.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But I mean, it's like you said, it's very hard for people to comprehend what that is like. Yep. So students who have been able to get out of Gaza, when they went back, they couldn't leave again.
Most of them, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
Ahmed?
Yeah. So I have a close story. Everyone in Palestine have his own story. I left Gaza on December 1st to meet with the United Nations Committee in Amman. Then when I ended this, it remains 3 months to my date here in the United States. So the normal situation to go back to my wife and my children, then travel again on the determined date. But I know if I go back to Gaza, I will lose this opportunity to come here to United States in my speaking tour. So I'm forced to still outside Gaza since 4 months to be able to participate in this tour. Another story, please. I met my friend from the West Bank just before a few days. He's far from me, just 60 kilometers, but I never met him inside Palestine. Me and him from the same people in the same land, but because of the blockade, because of the crossings, we cannot meet each other. Then finally, I met him here in Chicago. I wrote in my post, it's strange you cannot meet your friend from the same people, from the same land, in your home, then you meet him thousands of miles far.
Wow. The other thing that I don't think people realize, and unless you watch a documentary, you would never realize because it doesn't get talked about very much, but just the ability to move, to go from point A to B to C. Can you explain how that works?
So there's a saying in Gaza when people want to describe the space that they live in, like say there is a rumor or there is something that, you know, went viral. People use the term from fence to fence to describe Gaza as a place that exists between fences. Gaza is fenced from the north by Israeli border, fenced from the east by Israeli with the Israeli separation fence, shares a closed border with Egypt on the south, and its coastal shore is sealed off by Israeli warships. And Gaza is a small territory. It's the size of the city of Detroit. And because it's a narrow strip of land, when you stand on almost any roof in Gaza, if you look to the east, you could see the separation fence with Israel. And if you look to the west, you could see the Mediterranean Sea. So that's a daily reminder for people there of their eternal confinement, that they are trapped in this small territory. The refugees are unable to go home. Those who want to travel are unable to travel. And so our experience is defined by being stuck in this small territory that has no resources, that you know, we are unable to move freely, that we are unable to go and see the world. It's almost every day in Gaza, we're reminded of this reality of our isolation and of our experience there.
Noam, these details do not get talked about very much in the mainstream media, the conversation that is being had in this country about Israel-Palestine. And this is one of the reasons why these tours, these events that you all put on, are so important, to actually bring people from Gaza and the West Bank, invite them here, and then have a dialogue. Can you talk about that and the importance of having these kinds of conversations?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's crucial that people here in the United States hear directly from Palestinians and directly from Palestinians from Gaza about the situation over there and about the daily lives, as we've just heard from Ahmed and Jihad. It's not talked about enough. When people talk about the Middle East or Palestine and Israel in specifically, the conversation in the United States typically is centered on the thoughts and feelings of Israeli Jews and American Jews and Christian Zionists and other groups that support Israel. And it's a really it's a missed opportunity, because we're missing more than half of the story if that's the only voices that we are listening to. And I'm so grateful that, you know, we managed to brought Ahmed here so that more people can be exposed to his vision and his daily life. And I'm sorry we asked you to make this big sacrifice of not seeing your kids and your family for so long. But I really think there's no alternative than to listen to the entire story.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and you? The process involved in you learning about what's going on in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
Yeah.
And why you're passionate about this.
Well, I grew up in Israel. I'm Jewish. I was raised with a lot of fear towards Palestinians. It was a big part of my education in school and at home, we need to be afraid. And there's a lot of mistrust. I never had Palestinian friends growing up. They were not in my neighborhood. I mean, it's totally segregated, the living environment in Israel and Palestine. There are very few places where Palestinians and Jewish kids go to the same school. It's almost unheard of. My journey towards learning more about Palestine went through my military service. You know, military service is mandatory for Israeli Jews, and I did my service and learned a lot through that experience. Actually, it was a really long journey for me to come to be able to speak about issues like the right of return. And accept that, you know, that it is a right. Yeah. It's not up to me. It's not up to anyone to do away with that right. And a big part of that was coming to the United States, actually. I've lived in the United States for 12 years now. Yeah. And it does something to the mind and to the soul, I think, to be a few thousand miles away and see things from a different perspective and get to meet more people. I met more Palestinians in the United States in my first 3 or 4 years here than I ever met in my life before. Wow. That's a real tragedy, you know?
We're going to take a quick break. That is Noam Perry. He's Program Associate of Economic Activism at the American Friends Service Committee, and they are hosting Ahmed and Jihad. They will be speaking tomorrow night in Berkeley at 7 o'clock at St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue. If you live outside of the area, they will then go on to San Diego, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, New York, Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Jihad Abu Salim, a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza, currently studying at NYU. He has been in the U.S. for 5 years, and unfortunately, he cannot go back to Gaza to visit friends and family. We're also joined by Ahmed Abu Artima, a Palestinian journalist, poet, activist, and refugee. He is one of the original organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with artists about sexual harassment. Nevertheless is a new show that draws its name from the feminist rallying cry, Nevertheless, She Persisted. It combines song and dance and comedy, and artists and performers will focus on a range of common experiences from being told to smile to being followed home at night. So we'll talk tomorrow about how creative expression is challenging harassment. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are speaking with Ahmed Abu Artima, a Palestinian journalist, poet, activist, and one of the original organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return. Last week, a commission set up by the UN released findings that Israeli forces may have committed war crimes by targeting children, journalists, medics, and people with disabilities during that protest. Between March and December, 189 Palestinians, including 35 children, were killed. More than 6,000 people were injured. We're also joined by Jihad Abu Salim, a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza, currently studying at NYU. He's been here for 5 years, and he cannot return for fear that he would not be able to come back to the United States. And Noam Perry is Program Associate of Economic Activism at the American Friends Service Committee. They are hosting Jihad and Ahmed. They will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. Then they're going on to San Diego, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, New York, Washington, and Atlanta. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we get to our calls, I wanted to ask you, Ahmed, just about basic necessities. Clean water, electricity. What is that like in the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, I will try to make imagination about image how the people live inside Gaza. As I told before, according to the United Nations, Gaza is an livable place just in the next year. The people inside Gaza, in general, they are without medical services because of Israel impose restrictions on the materials which enter Gaza. No basic materials, no medicine, and the patients they forced to wait for long months before they got a permit from Israeli authorities to take a cure in West Bank or in Jerusalem, and a lot of times Israel prevent them. So hundreds of patients were dying, died in the 12 years. Unemployment is very high. No clean water for drinking. No food security in Gaza Strip. The people haven't the ability to buy to supply their families by the basic food. Imagine a lot of children. The majority of children are deprived from their basic from their simple things. When a child asked him father that his father that he wanted a toy, or he wanted to get a delicious food on a Friday, then he feel ashamed because he cannot give his child his simple dream. So the collective punishment imposed on Gaza, it targets children, mm-hmm. targets civilians, targets patients who died. Hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian youth without work, without jobs, they are not be able to see the future. They haven't any hope because natural conditions or natural reasons, because of the Israeli policy. Israel put the Palestinians inside Gaza. And by the way, 70% from the Palestinians inside Gaza are refugees. This means their origin homes is not inside Gaza. Their origin homes beyond the fence, the Israeli fence. These people in real prison. When I came here to Chicago, then my friend Jihad showed me the city and said to me, "Look, Ahmed, this is Chicago." And I asked him, "Where's the fence?" because in Gaza you cannot imagine the world is very very big. And when I left Gaza, Rafah crossing, finally, I wrote, and I feel in my inside me that finally I can take the car and cross hundreds of miles without borders, without fences. It's nice feeling to feel that you have your freedom. Mm-hmm. That's you will not see words that the place you can move inside ended, has ended. So the people inside Gaza in real prison, and they are suffering. They are without electricity. Imagine the electricity inside Gaza cut off for 12 to 16 continuous hours, then come 4 hours, then cut off again. So when I be in Gaza, I can know that the times the electricity come on. When I be inside my home, and suddenly I listened from my neighbors' children said, "Hey," so I know in that moment that the electricity finally come. Mm. My children, when the electricity came on, they race toward the television to see some shows for children before it cut off again. So this is what we try to let the people know. The people who are under pressure and under injustice and who pay the price, they are the civilians, they are the children, they are human. Like us, all of us, we are humans, but they are deprived from their basic rights, their human rights. Why? What's the reason to commit collective punishment toward all these people?
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to comment on an incredible cynicalness of our government, in that our policies with Israel really have to do with treating it like a military base more than anything, so that we can be close to the oil fields. It really doesn't have to do with religion. And the second thing I want to say is that when you consider an economic blockade, whether it's of the Gaza or of Cuba or Venezuela, we have to understand these as criminal acts, in which we treat people like vermin, actually, and starve them out in a way that's unconscionable. And they make the dialogue, it's sort of like the dialogue that is engaged against climate change. They make it sound like it's about anti-Semitism, but that's just a distraction. And I say that as a Jewish American. This is not about religion. This is about power and oil and land rights. It has nothing to do with morality or spirituality or religion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ariane. Jihad, would you like to respond?
Yes. That's why the power of the people matters here in the U.S. That's why we come here with a simple and clear message. We want our rights. And we can only achieve this by building these connections with progressives, with people of color, with organizations and groups that not only work for bettering the future of Palestine or Palestinians, but also for creating a better world. Ever since we came to the U.S., Ahmed and I, and ever since I stepped foot in this country, I managed to meet and talk to really amazing activists and organizers and people from who work on many, many progressive issues in the U.S., environment, women rights issues, people who try to further the progressive agenda. And that's why I invite all of these people, and I really thank Ariane for her comments. And I invite all people to listen to this voice, to listen to the voice of Americans and those within the American Jewish community who see the truth, who see what's going on, and to join the conversation and to challenge the stereotypes and to challenge the political status quo in America. There is a young generation in the U.S. now that is no longer informed by mainstream media that has its biases. There is a younger generation that, thanks to social media, can see what's going on in Palestine, that understands that what's happening in Palestine is about human rights. It's about values and a vision for a future without walls. The wall is the theme of the struggle for progressive politics in the U.S. today. And this is what defines our struggle back in Palestine too, where walls are physical, but they're also metaphors that speak about who wants to keep their privileges at the expense of other people. We want to change this reality. We want a better future for all without physical and mental walls and fences.
And Noam, as an Israeli who's lived in the U.S. for 12 years, what would you add?
Yeah, I wanted to thank Ariane so much for your first comment about U.S. policy. You know, it's true, Israel is a repressive regime, and the closure of Gaza, the blockade, is Israeli policy, and Egyptian, to a lesser degree, probably. But the unconditional support of Israel is U.S. policy, and we can't let the United States government off the hook for this humanitarian crisis. The United States is giving Israel $3.8 billion a year in military aid. So Israel has to use that money to buy products from American weapon manufacturers. So in a sense, the United States taxpayers are subsidizing the U.S. military industry by sending money to Israel. And we can't let the U.S. Weapon manufacturers off the hook either, because they have lobbyists and they depend on that money. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, all of those. It's a big industry. And the entire system is complicit in what's going on in Gaza.
Mm. We have a question from Carolyn, who says, what do you all see as a solution? It seems to me that a cohesive country that encompasses the West Bank and Gaza and a real democracy with equal rights would solve the problem. Because of the settlements, even though they're illegal per international standards, which I cannot see going away, I don't see how a Palestinian independent state can work. It seems that the current problems will continue for people in Gaza and the West Bank, and Palestinians within Israel can see and interact with each other. So why don't you all talk about this? What do you see as a real solution? Ahmed, why don't you start?
You mean what's the solution I see?
Yes, given what Carolyn said, you've got the settlements, you have the Gaza and the West Bank.
I believe in peace. I believe in equality between peoples. I believe in human rights for all people, to establish country based on humanity, not based on racism or based on occupation. So this is what we struggle for. We struggle for justice for all. We struggle for solution will be in benefit of the all. We don't struggle just for the freedom and dignity and justice for my people, Palestinians. Yes, this is very important. But also we struggle for to free the Israelis from the fences, from the fear, to free them from the fear. So you cannot feel stability forever while you build your state at expense of others on the mountains of victims. So let us struggle together in one struggle for peace for all, justice for all, dignity for all. I liked the life here in United States because I saw multicultures here, a lot of cultures, and they can live together with respect in the same country. So we can make the same thing in the Holy Land. The Palestinians, the Palestinian refugees, and the Israelis can live in the same land with peace, with equality, with human rights, not based on occupation. This occupation should be ended because it's unnormal to continue.
Jihad, what would you add? And if you can talk about specifics. Mm. What would it look like exactly? I mean, Carolyn brings up settlements. Mm. What would this look like?
We are already in a one-state situation. Mm. The question is, how do we change the reality from a one-state situation where a certain group of people have access to resources and privileges and enjoy citizenship rights because of who they are, and others don't? Also because of who they are. Yesterday we spoke at the Kehila Community Synagogue here in Oakland, and a member of the synagogue asked the same question, and my colleague Dalit, who also works at the American Friends Service Committee here in Oakland, answered by saying that all the genius and all the research and thinking and resources that are dedicated to building walls and building these sophisticated devices of control and that are lethal, that target innocent people, if we put a little bit of this energy into thinking about the future, into thinking about a cohesive country for all, we would be able to do so. And I think the first step in this is to have this conversation, is to acknowledge that Palestinians want to go home. Their plight, the refugee plight, cannot continue forever. There are millions of Palestinians who are living in miserable conditions in refugee camps, and they want to go home. This is their simple demand, and it's a human demand. It's something that makes them feel they are human, because no one wants to set precedents that states and countries achieve majority or are built by this policy of control, demographic control, and choosing who lives in a certain land and who doesn't. So I invite our friends and colleagues and allies to think with us about the answer and to imagine a future. It's doable and it's achievable. And as Ahmed said yesterday, 85% of the land, almost 85% of the land on which Palestinian refugees lived before 1948, before the establishment of the State of Israel, are either empty or have low population density. There can be a recipe. There can be a recipe for living together and for sharing the land and for reconciling all narratives and connections to it.
Noam, what would you add?
Yeah, I don't think I can say it much better than Jihad and Ahmed. I want to say, the details are sometimes important, but sometimes not. So, yeah, there are illegal settlements. They can be dismantled. They can, we can figure this out. The question is about political will and also the emotional will to see, let's start with seeing Palestinians as humans. Okay. Let's start with recognizing that they have dreams that are not different than ours, that they have families, that they want to travel, that they deserve food and water. Let's start with that. And then once we establish that, then we can figure out the details.
Mm. I want to ask you, the time is going by so quickly, but I want to ask you, Ahmed, about the protest.
Yeah.
Because you wrote in, you wrote in the New York Times about the protest. Al Jazeera did an incredible documentary about the protest. And so many people lost their lives. So many people lost limbs.
Yeah.
Your friends.
Yeah.
The UN just came out with this report saying that Israeli forces may have committed war crimes by targeting children, journalists, yeah. medics who had on medical vests, yeah. and people with disabilities.
Yeah.
I wish we had another hour to really go into this, but I mean, how are people doing? So many people lost their legs. I was just watching this mini doc about these young Palestinians who are playing soccer with one leg.
Yeah, this make us and make me personally more sad. Mm. And in the same time, it makes me more understanding that the occupation is very bad, is very expensive for us. It's burden on our life. So the problem doesn't start with the March of Return. March of Return was a react, was a scream for life, was a knock on the doors of a prison. The people inside Gaza really died before the March of Return. So they decided to share in the March of Return. You cannot blame the victim. Palestinians are victims. Israel didn't start kill us with the March of Return. They killed us on 1948 when they expelled us from our lands. Then they killed us by occupation. Then they killed us by siege. Then they killed us by massacres, by prisons. Then they killed the people by the youth people when they let them without hope, without a future. Then finally they killed us when we share in the March of Return, and when we decide to say no for death, yes for life. So we should support these victims. We should say for Israel, no. Israel continues its crimes because it feels impunity. It feels no accountability. These crimes, it's not the fault of the people who decide to say no. It's the fault of the occupation. We cannot imagine how the world in the 21st century, which all this civilization, all this human values, all these principles of equality, of justice, then there is a country defined itself that it's democratic state, then they put the people inside the prisons, not just in Gaza, also in the West Bank. They put them inside the prisons, inside fences. We should fall this fences. We should struggle together to create a world better, to create a world without fences, to create a world where the people can move freely, can take and get the same rights simply because they are human, regardless of who they are.
Is healthcare available for people who have been injured in Gaza?
Again?
Is healthcare for people who were injured, is that available?
Unfortunately, no. And this is one of the reasons make this crisis worse, because the people who injured in the protests, there are no medical services enough. They cannot leave Gaza to take a cure outside, and this is one of the aspects of this cruel siege. This cruel siege kill humans, kill patients. So all the world, all the people who believe in justice and believe in human rights should show their solidarity and say no for this occupation.
We are going to take one more call and then we'll get thoughts. And Jihad, I'll ask you to tell us about Gaza Unlocked. Let's hear from Benjamin in San Francisco. Hi, Benjamin. We're almost out of time, but we wanted to take your call.
Hi there. I'm an Israeli who left Israel when I was 18, and Israel is based on racist laws. As long as they don't take care of these core values and laws that separate between Jews and Arabs. There is, I don't see how there is any way to move forward. And all these atrocities are committed in the name of Jews being somehow superior. And this you can see that in all the laws.
Well, thank you for calling. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. Jihad, just quickly, what about the laws? And we don't have much time.
The laws?
Laws in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, the Israel, the main conversation now in Israel is about Israel being a Jewish state. And that has legal manifestations that we feel their implications as Palestinians who are in Gaza and the West Bank, Palestinian citizens of Israel, on a daily basis. The term Jewish state translates into keeping privileges and rights into a certain group and depriving another from such privileges and rights. And the nation state law that the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, just passed in the past few months is the logical conclusion of the continuation of such logic, whereas there's one narrative, there's one story, there's one language, and the rest is irrelevant. And by that, Israel continues to erase our history as Palestinian Arabs, Muslim and Christian, and erase our connection to the land.
Jihad Abu Salim is a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza, currently studying at NYU. He has been here for 5 years and cannot go back to Gaza. Ahmed Abu Artima is a Palestinian journalist, poet, activist, and refugee. He is one of the original organizers of the Gaza Great March of Return. Noam Perry is with American Friends Service Committee. He's an Israeli who served in the IDF and has lived in the United States for 12 years. Ahmed and Jihad will be speaking tomorrow night in Berkeley at 7 p.m. St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue. You can also see them if you're outside of the area in San Diego, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, New York, Washington, and Atlanta. Ahmed, Jihad, and Noam, thank you so much for
coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.